The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
So, for the first time in 9 years, Brett Easton Ellis is back with us here on The Last Word at FM. Great to see you again. Thank you very much for joining us. Your new book is your first non-fiction book, isn't it? White.
It is. It is.
Why turn to non-fiction?
Well, if you want the truth, and I want to give you the truth, my agent and my publisher were asking me to put together a collection of my essays over the years. And I've written a few over the past 25, 30 years or so. None of them were good. None of them were, I didn't want any of them to be collected. Stuff I wrote in the 80s, stuff I wrote in the 90s, I didn't like any of them. Stuff I wrote for Rolling Stone, youth culture pieces. So this went back and forth for about 3 or 4 years. I don't want to collect my essays. And then someone mentioned, well, you do this podcast. I have a podcast in the U.S. called the Brett Easton Ellis Podcast. And I start off every podcast with a kind of rant. It could be a movie review. It could be something about something that's going on in popular culture. And a friend of mine was looking through these rants with me and said, you know, I think there is a book here. If you put, you have a nonfiction book. If you take a group of these rants that you've done over the last 4 or 5 years, thematically, there's many of the same things run through them all. And maybe that's the book. And then I became convinced, and the book came together pretty quickly. And that's how White happened.
Which attacks, amongst other things,
attacks
Generation Wuss, which has been consumed by victim narratives and anxiety and neediness. You give out about their oversensitivity, their sense of entitlement, their insistence that they're always right, despite sometimes overwhelming proof to the contrary, their joint tendencies of overreaction and passive-aggressive possibility.
Ooh, what an attack. I live with a millennial. I've lived with a millennial for 10 years now, and I got to know, of course, him and a lot of his friends, and just people socially that I know, fans of mine, people on social media, and I started tweeting about differences I saw between my generation and my partner's generation, and it was always under the hashtag Generation Wuss, overly sensitive, easily triggered by things that I could not even imagine being triggered by. And
give us examples of that.
Well, it was usually stuff that was happening in a film. It was usually, you know, quite seriously, the whole conversation started because there was a famous case in the U.S. about two boys in a college freshman dorm. One of the boys pulled a prank on the other boy, filmed him without the boy knowing when he was making out with a young man. Kind of a joke. He was going to post it on the internet, but he didn't. And the other boy was so ashamed of this happening that he killed himself. And it became this kind of battle cry in the U.S. about, well, what was the crime, and was the crime that bad? Pulling a kind of dorm room prank on your roommate. My boyfriend thought it was serious enough, and I had a hard time wrapping my head around that one, for example. And that was, really, you're going to commit suicide because someone filmed you doing something and you're not laughing about it? You're not taking it in the spirit in which your roommate was doing it, as a prank, as a joke. And that was the divide. That was one of the big divides. And then it was usually just about reactions towards movies or song lyrics or cultural appropriation or political correctness or identity politics. Or cultural appropriation.
Our shutting down conversation. I was very interested to just even see today the former American Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who would be reviled by many on the left politically in the United States. He was speaking at Amherst College, according to a report in the Boston Globe. And there were attempts to actually stop him actually speaking. And he said, too often the school is favoring the heckler's disruption tactics of the speaker's First Amendment rights.
This is completely true, and this has been happening in the United States for many years now. In fact, I touch upon it in a section in White about Berkeley and what was happening to Berkeley in 2017, where the bastion of free speech, Berkeley College, was, quote unquote, censoring conservative speakers from coming on campus and talking. And we're not talking about hate groups. We're just talking about political commentators that have shows on network television. So it is a problem, and it is a widespread situation, and it is, I think, part of the problem on, and I'm saying this, you know, not as a pejorative, it is a problem with the left, this inability to, and by extension, to millennials.
But isn't there a line that has to be drawn? Because you do get to a stage where you can have hate speech, where you actually have incitement.
You're correct. But the question becomes, who decides what that is? Who decides what hate speech is? What group of people decide that? And then who, in fact, puts those language laws into place? That is a very dangerous door to open.
Well, let me give you another example. We'll have Bob Woodward on the program later.
Yes.
And one of the things we talk about is Joe Biden today announcing his candidacy for the American presidency. Right. And one of the things that he said provoked him to feel that he had to come back into active politics was the way Donald Trump handled what happened in Charlottesville and drew an equivalence between the people who were protesting and those who protested against what they were doing.
Well, what about the media who put Joe Biden under the same umbrella of Me Too and a sexual assaulter about a week and a half ago, where suddenly he was lumped in with everybody because he sidled up to women or he grabbed their shoulder or four or five women were interviewed on American TV saying, I felt very uncomfortable. He invaded my space. And the media actually went with this story for 2 or 3 days. And if you want an opposite perspective on that. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know where it's all going. I mean, Obama finally had to come out and warn everybody about that circular firing squad. You go for one target, great. They're worthy of your aim. But then you've got to be careful because soon you're going to be shooting at everybody and soon no one will have a voice. And that is a problem. This is the problem with living in a democracy, with free speech. There's terrible speech. What do you do about that? Who decides what that speech is and what people can and cannot say?
Yeah, I suppose there's issues of taste, but then who is the arbiter of taste? The issue perhaps comes when it's incitement, when it's... Well, it's maybe both sides are guilty of this in America, but how dispiriting is it that America seems to become so polarized?
So dispiriting. It is so sad. It is really depressing. And it is the main topic of conversation in America. And I have to say, both sides are tired of it. I have friends on the right. I have friends on the left. Everyone is tired of cancel culture. Everyone is tired of political correctness. Everyone is tired of identity politics. No one likes people getting doxxed on Twitter. It's a nonpartisan issue, I believe, right now, and it's formed into. I often wonder then why is it running rampant? If both sides really dislike it so much, then what's going on? I have friends who hate Trump, but they also hate this cancel culture that's going on, and they don't approve of conservative speakers not being allowed to speak on college campuses. Just because they hate Trump doesn't mean that they would allow that.
Of course, the book is not about Trump. It's about lots of other people. It's about Kanye West, Quentin Tarantino, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, all of those issues.
Yeah, it is. It is about a lot of other things. It's also about Patrick Bateman, of all people, this character I created who is the star of American Psycho, and how he has haunted me throughout my career ever since that book was published.
Haunted in what way? Because that sort of made you, wasn't it? I mean, you were the bright young thing.
An experimental novel that I expected to sell 4,000 copies of suddenly defines me. I thought my following novel was going to be my big popular novel, which was Glamorama, for those of you who don't know. But American Psycho seemed to me to be a very strange, very personal novel that I didn't see have any large commercial prospects. Because, I mean, if you read it, some of the complaints will be, oh my God, page after page of descriptions of clothing and furniture and these endless conversations and some very extreme violence. And so I find it strange that my career is defined by this book and by this character who I didn't even have a face for Patrick Bateman when I was working on that book. He was just this faceless embodiment of yuppie culture and the greed of the Reagan 80s.
But wasn't Donald Trump one of his heroes?
Donald Trump is in American Psycho, the novel.
So it's your fault.
Hero.
You started. You brought Donald Trump
so
to global attention to the book.
It was so prescient. No, it was interesting because I was doing a lot of research. Well, not a lot, but some research with guys who worked on Wall Street, kind of figuring out what was going on in 1987. And I was really surprised that they all saw Trump as an aspirational figure. They'd all read The Art of the Deal. They all looked up to him. They all wanted to be him. He seemed to embody a kind of 80s ethos that they wanted to embrace. I found him a buffoonish and maybe a little comical. And so I thought, oh, wouldn't it be funny if Donald Trump becomes the daddy that Patrick Bateman never had? And I think he's mentioned in the novel 40 or 43 times. Patrick Bateman's always looking for articles about him. Patrick Bateman always wants to know where Trump's favorite pizza is. He's always traveling up to Trump Tower and staring at it, zoning out.
But doesn't that say something, that you caught the zeitgeist so many years before everyone else? You saw the compellingness or compellability of Donald Trump as a character,
well,
perhaps.
Well, there was something compelling about him. There was something compelling him enough for him to have the number one bestseller of that year and for him to become so ubiquitous in New York culture. It felt like a bit of a joke, but honestly, a lot of things during that decade felt like a bit of a joke. And that's really what American Psycho is about.
Okay, American Psycho is the recommended reading. If you have a strong stomach for it, the violence was quite extreme.
A bit violent.
From 1987. Good God, is that long ago now?
It's actually 1991.
Now, I was wondering.
It
you
was
said
published
it
in
91.
I started writing in 87,
okay.
88. Yeah.
Right. Well, White is the new book. It's nonfiction. It's a collection of Bret Easton Ellis's essays, and they certainly are provocative, and they will get you thinking, which is the whole idea about essays. And Bret is speaking tonight at 7 o'clock. He's going to be in conversation with our good friend Nadine O'Regan at the O'Reilly Theatre in Belvedere College in Great Denmark Street. It's part of the International Literature Festival Dublin, and there are still tickets available. And if you want to get those tickets, if you go to ilfdublin.com. That's for the International Literature Festival, ilfdublin.com. 7 o'clock tonight with Nadine O'Regan. Bret Easton Ellis, thank you very much for joining us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.